J.R. Murdoch.
From
Jack Mangan. J.R. Murdoch. Deadpan.
Calling, are we reaching? See, it keeps hanging up. And it's a man answering.
The Wall is the 11th studio album by English progressive rock group Pink Floyd. It was released as a double album on November 30th, 1979. It was subsequently performed live with elaborate theatrical effects and adapted into the film Pink Floyd, The Wall.
Murdochopedia.
That's right. Wikipedia is my friend.
Well, actually, I want you to know. Yeah, so all right. I have a bunch of canned jokes, which I intend to unleash as we go here. That'll just be, you know, uproariously hilarious.
I'm sure they shall be.
But yes, we are talking Pink Floyd, The Wall. This is actually a different kind of palooza. Deadpan has actually not really done this kind of palooza before. But you know what? If you're out there listening and you're interested and you have something to say about The Wall, then absolutely send it in. It's absolutely welcome because, I mean, The Wall is, in my mind, one of the richest sources of art. It's one of the richest pieces of art, I think, that that our generation ever produced. Our generation being kids who grew up in the late 20th century.
And I believe it's for some people, a rather misunderstood piece of pop art that people might not get. And I know that for myself, as a younger adult in my teens, early 20s, I really didn't get it because I only listened to what they played on the radio. So for me to actually sit down, being obviously more mature, going back and listening to the entire album in its entirety, there were a lot of songs I had completely forgotten about. And it was a completely different experience. And it's like, wow, now I get it.
Really? And you get it? Awesome. Explain it to me.
It's about all these little men with little bricks and they stack them up and...
Oh, it's Tetris.
Yes, it's Tetris for the 1979 crowd.
Right. Actually, that was called Breakout back then.
Bung, bung, bung.
Wow, now that's impressive. So anyway, yes, you've got Jack Mangan, that's me. I am Jack Mangan, a.k.a. Bob Hoskins. And
I am J.R. Murdoch, another brick in the wall.
In the flesh. Or no, wait, in the flesh? That's track one. Let's see. There you go. That was one of my first jokes.
It's so, Jack and JR in the flesh. Wait, that just sounds dirty.
Yeah, you're skating on the thin ice now.
That I am.
So let's talk about there's just so damn much to talk about. I mean, in Pink Floyd's career, I think this was fairly obvious. I mean, they were headed in this direction. I mean, Roger Waters was ironically or not ironically, was building a wall between himself and his bandmates, kind of becoming isolated, becoming, you know, more and more, the output was getting more and more, there's more and more depth to the output, but it just made sense. This was the natural progression from, you know, a great band with a lot of brilliant albums, but The Wall was, wasn't the Pink Floyd's final album with Roger Waters, but it was their, obviously their ultimate album. The one they released after that was sort of just kind of a coda on the Roger Waters Pink Floyd era.
It's easy to say that it was probably the happiest days of their lives.
Yes, but you know, sadly they wouldn't bring the boys back home until it was almost too late. But you know, I think Pink Floyd's at their best. I think during the era when Roger Waters was kind of the band's front man, when he was working with, or at least mostly working with, Richard Wright and Nick Mason, and of course David Gilmour. I think this, for my money, this is for my money. For my money, this is the about as good as rock music gets. About, you know, the musical depth and musical emotional depth, lyrical depth. I think I don't think they've ever been matched, and I honestly don't know if they will be.
And I find it really interesting as you go back through the whole Pink Floyd discography. I mean, this is their 11th album, and as you said, this is kind of the penultimate Waters Gilmore compilation before everything really started to fall apart. And it's so intense in it, every level on the album. I mean, any song that you listen to by itself has a different mood, but when you listen to the whole thing, it really just runs the gamut of emotion, and it's like, holy cow. And I think that's what I really got from it, listening to the whole thing. I mean, I just put on my headphones and popped it on my iPod and started listening, and it was like, wow. You know, 2 hours later, I'm going, okay, I need to just take a shower or something. I don't know what to think about all that.
Yeah, it is emotionally exhausting to go through it, and it truly conveys the emotion of the album better than almost anything, again, in rock music. I know that there are some people who are deeply, deeply moved by certain operas and who really feel that the operas resonate with them. And of course, you know, there was a time when people were calling this type of thing rock operas. And, you know, The Who, everything they put out was this rock opera. But, you know what? The Wall is not about a deaf, dumb, and blind kid playing pinball. I mean, that's, you know, the Wall actually goes... It really, you know, who can relate to that, and who is really charged up by that idea? But, you know, I mean, everyone can kind of relate to the feelings of isolation and the feelings of frustration and depression and sadness and hopelessness that Pinky experiences throughout the album.
And I think that's one of the things that The Wall captured that, say, Tommy really didn't. Tommy was, yeah, it was a good rock opera type of album. It followed a storyline. It followed a person's life. The Wall got into the person's head. It got into Pink's head totally. And it made you go, whoa, I can really see where he's having this up and down emotional roller coaster, and then just wraps himself up in his wall and shuts off from the world. And it's like, whoa, it's just intense. And I don't think anything prior to The Wall really captured that emotional intensity like The Wall did. And I think it's because they really didn't concentrate solely on, oh, every song has to be a rock song. Every song has to be poppy and upbeat. Some of these songs are just strange, to for lack of a better word. They just don't sound like your typical rock band producing something. It's fitting a specific emotion for that specific time in the character's life through the album. And I think that's what I really got from it was, oh, it isn't every song that they play on the radio. You know, they play five or six of the songs on the radio and that's it. But there's so much more to the album than that.
Yeah, and to build on what you're saying there, as far as I understood, they were always a little bit baffled by the popularity of the song Another Brick in the Wall, because they said that song was kind of a little jab at the disco kind of crap that was still somewhat popular back in 1980. So they were kind of lampooning that stuff a little bit. And then that song ended up being probably, I think, their biggest commercial hit. Their biggest hit single ever. And then, of course, you know, it took many years before Comfortably Numb really caught on kind of classic rock radio. That format kind of was born, and Comfortably Numb, I guess, saw kind of a renaissance then, which, of course, that is kind of the, not necessarily the climax of the album, but it's one of the most powerful songs, and it's one of the most immediately identifiable Pink Floyd songs.
Right, because it just comes right out. And I mean, when that song hits, especially on the movie, when you're watching the movie as well, everything just sort of gets all muddled and all you have is the music. So you got all the people in the background talking and Pink is just totally out. He's obviously not there, not paying attention, and everyone's just doing everything around him. And it's like, whoa, he's just totally disconnected there. And I think that visual for me was probably the most stunning in the movie when that song came on. It was like, wow, that's... words escape me at that point.
Yeah, and you know what, let's beat up on the movie a little bit before I would really like to get into what the album is all about, what the story is and what's going on. But first, let's beat up on the movie a little bit, because I think I think you hit it for me just now. I mean, the movie is really, I don't really enjoy the pacing. Watching the movie, now granted, the storyline is pretty depressing, and it's about this bastard, really, who, yes, you do relate to him, but he's a bastard. Pink Floyd, you know, the character of Pink Floyd does some terrible stuff that's really inexcusable, and it's not really an enjoyable movie. And I think it drags a little bit. There's a lot with the childhood stuff that just kind of feels slow. But then, you know, you got these unforgettable, you know, animated sequences and a couple of scenes with Bob Geldof that are absolutely unforgettable, like the Comfortably Numb that you mentioned, and One of My Turns where he trashes the hotel room.
Oh yeah, that's fun to watch, but it's like as soon as that come down happens and you move into Comfortably Numb, it's like, whoa, there you go. It just brings all that whole scene together.
Yeah, exactly. And but, you know, I think the animation and the movie does end well with the animated stuff. But, you know, I think obviously the marching hammers and the judge, who is basically a big, literally an ass. And, you know, just that kind of imagery. Also, the animation of the school children marching into the meat grinder. I mean, it's very, you know, it's iconic. It's iconic stuff. I mean, and again, it's all social commentary, but it's a. That's the stuff that anyone who's watched the movie will remember.
Yeah, not just the kids walking to the meat grinder, but all the kids with the faceless masks on. That's what got me about it, is saying that they're just bricks in the wall. It went beyond that, saying that these are just nameless, faceless people that just, they're just there to prevent him from being able to do what he wants to do and to push him back to where he needs to be. And I think that was what they're trying to get at with that, is that, you know, yeah, there's a lot of people in his life, but most of them are just nameless, faceless, don't matter. They're just there. They're window dressing.
True, yeah. But, you know, I also kind of think that it's a commentary. The movie, more than the album, the movie really draws parallels between, and it does this intentionally. It does this very conspicuously. It will draw, like in the very beginning, the flashbacks of his father in the war, one of the guys, one of the wounded, is all bandaged up, and his bandages, of course, are identical to the kids' faceless kind of visages that they wear as they march. I think it's also about how the dehumanizing effect of war, of school, and also of fandom, of just kind of, he's kind of trying to say that, you know, these people kind of all blend together and become, you know, less than, and just become bricks in the wall. I mean, they become basically unimportant little pieces of a bigger structure that really don't matter as individuals in war, as fans, and as students.
Yep, he gets wrapped up in his own little world, and he's the only thing that's important at that point.
Right, and you know, I mean, let's do this. Let's, you know, from the start. I mean, you're introduced to, you know, it starts off right away. You know, at, they focus a little bit on his childhood, and you get the sense of you know, that there's this loss where his father was killed in World War II, you know, fighting for the Allies, fighting for England in World War II, and I believe he was either killed by a plane or he flew in a plane, and he was killed in World War II, and then, you know, lived with this smothering mother figure who obviously, you know, was overbearing and kind of started him on his wall building. And of course, you know, going to school and having a rough time at school, and with the schoolmaster, he feels like the schoolmasters are basically persecuting him and treating him like a faceless, you know, nobody who's just to be marched into the meat grinder. You know, he's just getting more and more isolated. And then, of course, it jumps to, you know, we don't see him become a rock star. It just kind of jumps from his childhood to, you know, when he's already kind of married and a rock star, and he's already kind of a bastard to his wife.
Yeah, that kind of progresses fairly quickly, like you said, from school. It talks about his writing poetry, and they teach the schoolmaster's making fun of him for writing poetry and showing all the kids what he's writing. And in the movie, they actually went and read some of the lyrics, and I believe some of the lyrics were actually out of Dark Side of the Moon when they read some of the lyrics. And I thought that was interesting that they brought that in.
Yeah, that was from Money.
Yeah, that was kind of clever the way they did that part. And then they sort of jumped straight out of that. And as you mentioned, to go straight from school to there was one song, Mother, where, you know, he's basically saying, hey, Mama, do you approve of this girl that I'm going to go out with? And then, bam, he's a rock star. It's like, oh, that was the only abrupt jump in the entire sequence, is going from, okay, he's getting married to he's a rock star.
Well, I think it was Goodbye Blue Sky, I think, was the jump. But you're right. It still was very – it still covered a lot of years.
And it kind of makes you wonder what happened in there. But you can kind of guess in there, because you got the phone call that he makes back to England to talk to his wife, and of course a man answers.
Yes.
And of course, obviously, what's good for the goose is good for the gander is kind of what's happening there. He's off womanizing in the United States, and his wife is back there at home sleeping with somebody else.
Right. And it's in the song before Young Lust is the one where he's off saying, like, you know, where I need a dirty woman. Then he calls home and he's sad because, you know, a man answers, and he gets the most clueless operator in the world. Like, why is a man answering your phone? I don't understand. It's like, oh, come on, lady. But before that is Empty Spaces, where, you know, he's kind of revealing that he's not really the nicest guy.
Oh, yeah. I think just a little side note here, that actual phone call was Roger Waters calling, I want to say it was his manager, at home, and he had no idea who was calling, and he was just hanging up, and he actually recorded that with the operator, and the operator was like, "You're trying to reach your wife?" So that confusion is actually real. It was funny. It's like, wait, he actually did that?
Wow, that's pretty cool. And so that the clueless operator was real. That wasn't
was a real clueless operator.
Wow. And actually, you know, looking at the album layout, you know, I might be getting myself a little bit jumbled. Sorry, and I'm sure Roger Waters is listening, so sorry. But it's actually in Don't Leave Me Now where he kind of, you know, he kind of lets us know that he wants her around to beat to a pulp on a Saturday night. So, you know, that's when we kind of recognize that Pinky is not, he's not really our hero. I mean, we're watching him and we're identifying with him and we're feeling his pain, but, you know, and we're cheering for him to get better, but we're not really cheering on his exploits. I mean, he's not, he's certainly not, he's the hero and the protagonist, but he's not, you know, the good guy.
Yeah, it's the whole story of the man versus himself type of situation.
Right.
You want to feel bad for him, and then you realize, well, he's kind of a schmuck. He kind of deserves what he's getting, but, you know, based on how his life went, it's like, well, okay, who really did the most damage to him?
And you know, I'd say a lot of, I mean, as brilliant as all the music is, I think a lot of the guitar, you know, David Gilmour's guitar work on this album is all really beautiful. And of course, the first side ends very powerfully with a very simple song. And the story at that point is that, I mean, at least as I interpret it, at that point, this is his first suicide attempt, is in Goodbye Cruel World.
And I would tend to agree there. And I think that's where, like you said, at the end of album one, Goodbye Cruel World, he tries his suicide attempt, and he even leads into that with Young Lust, where it says, do you want to see me fly? Would you like to see me try? It's like, okay, he's kind of flaunting with death there, but Goodbye Cruel World is where he actually tries to overdose and kill himself. And starting with album two, side three, it's where he's starting to come back, going, he's trapped inside himself, going, okay, is there anybody out there?
Right.
You know, and that's a creepy song when you got that, you know, is there anybody out there? It's like, ooh, just gives you chills when you listen to it.
Yes. But then it leads into what is one of my favorite of the beautiful guitar pieces, the opening of Nobody's Home, or Nobody Home, which is, again, you know, this is his most human moment. This is where we finally get a Pinky character that we feel for and that we want. Than that we like, and we actually do have real pathos and sympathy for this guy who's and I get the impression that I think you're absolutely right. He's trapped inside himself, but I get the impression that he's also literally, you know, and he's talking about, hey, you out there in the hall. I get the impression that he's literally been locked up for his suicide attempt. I get the impression that he's the papers holding their folded faces to the floor, you know, in a mental institution somewhere. That's what I'm reading there.
And I took away something completely different from that. See, the wall, he built the wall, and his mother helped, his wife helped, the teachers helped, everyone helped build this wall. And to me, it's him talking to himself. It's the little boy trapped behind that wall saying, hey, did anybody forget about me? And he's trying to recapture what's on the outside so that he can be himself once more. The wall was basically put around to protect his little boy self, and outside he has this demonstrative exterior, the womanizing rock star bastard that's out there doing everything. And you got the little boy inside going, you know, hey, I really just want to come out. I really just want to come out and play. Can you let me out again? And that's what I got from that when I listened to it. And I'm sure you're right. He probably did end up getting put locked up at that point. But I still think that it's a battle internally versus a battle externally.
Yeah, I totally agree. I agree 100%. And I think that that's what's significant. You know, his actual physical surroundings are less relevant than himself. And actually, what you said, I think, is dead on, because I certainly didn't want to leave out how Nobody Home begins with an old man voice shouting, I've got a little black book with me poems in it, you know, which is going back to this helpless kid who's getting picked on by his schoolmaster. And you're right, it's heart-wrenching, because here's this old man who kind of, you're right, he's still got the little boy in him, and he's becoming more and more withdrawn, and he doesn't want to be here. He doesn't want to be where he is. And Now it goes from there into Vera, which...
That song will tear you down when you start listening to it, because actually Vera, Vera Lynn, I think, was actually a World War II singer. And I believe it was somebody that Roger Waters' dad actually listened to. And Roger Waters actually lost his dad in World War II.
Right.
So, and that was the powerful meaning behind, you know, does anybody remember Vera? Was he was remembering songs that his dad used to listen to. And again, you're getting back to the little boy trying to get back his childhood at that point. And it's like, and I think that's the deep intensity of that. And it's like, holy crap.
Yeah. Hang on. I need a minute. Hang on. I was just kidding. But what I've also heard
speculation. Sorry.
It's all right. It'll be all right. I've heard also speculation. Of course, this is just talk, I'm sure. But that it was not a coincidence. I mean, yes, Vera Lynn was actually a World War II singer that a lot of the GIs really, really loved. But also that the fact that Vera Lynn sounds like Berlin is not a coincidence.
It's not. Yeah, no, it's definitely. And I believe that's where he lost his dad, was in Berlin.
Oh, okay. See, that I didn't know. But, you know, Berlin was obviously the home of the Nazis. I mean, this is the home of the evil that killed his father, who then, as the album progresses, and I'm jumping a little bit ahead, we'll get there, but this is what Pinky starts to emulate, you know, not his dad, but, you know, the evil totalitarians who killed his dad, the evil fascists who, you know, ultimately started the war and shot his dad down. But, you know, of course, before that, I think they show it this way in the movie, I believe is actually another moment where he kind of collapses, and that's Comfortably Numb. I think this is his final, collapse, but it's another collapse on Pink's part.
Right, that's where he locks himself in his hotel room after, and this is where the movie varies from the album, is I believe Comfortably Numb comes shortly after Young Lust and a couple other songs, where Comfortably Numb, he actually has his breakdown in the hotel room. And that's where they move Comfortably Numb before a lot of these other songs. And he's sitting in the chair, just zoned out, watching the TV. They're pounding on the door. And all of a sudden, in comes the hotel manager and his manager. And they're like, okay, we got to get him up on the stage. You know what? We can't just leave him sit here. And they just start shooting him up and wheel him on out to the show.
Right. The show must go on. And
exactly.
I think that is his voice saying the show must go on. But, you know, at this point, actually, I need to take a quick detour from our discussion of the wall and just let you know that in honor of the wall, I have actually, for this recording, JR, I have shaved off all the hair off of my body.
Yes, I only shaved off my eyebrows. I apologize. I didn't go for the full body shave.
Yeah, you know, around Deadpan, we like to talk about greasy nipples. But, you know, in the wall, they get into bloody nipples, which is that's nothing I'm interested in. That's the scene just always makes me kind of cringe when he's shaving and he cuts his nipple. It's like, oh, no, yeah. That didn't need to happen.
Yeah, and then he cuts his nipples, cuts his, I mean, he hacks away at his eyebrows, and he just goes to the sink, just the blood dripping into the sink, and it's like, oh, God, what the hell did he just, oh, God, he didn't.
Right. Yeah, and you know what, yeah, you see that blood dripping, and for a couple of minutes on your first viewing, you don't really know what's going on. You're like, oh, crap, is he, you know, what's he doing? But yeah, yeah, exactly.
Yeah, you're wondering, did he just, was this another suicide attempt?
But yeah, then there is the comfortably numb moment, and the song has been kind of beaten to death on FM classic rock radio, but it still is a very, very powerful. It's a powerful rock song. It's, you know, brilliant guitar soloing, and it's a very simple but powerful and moving riff, and you know, very great lyrics. Again, you know, kind of reminiscing about childhood and his pain and the pain of his life, and of course. There are drugs involved. I mean, this is about Pinky. I don't think I always object when people say that you need drugs to enjoy Pink Floyd. I mean, I don't use drugs, and I totally get Pink Floyd. I really enjoy Pink Floyd, and I think it's much, you know, it's better, I think, straight, because you're getting everything. You're not missing stuff. I wouldn't want to do this stuff, you know, high or something. I think Pink Floyd is better when you're straight.
Well, there's so many different levels to get to it. When you're high, you're just feeling like, oh, this song is nice and mellow, and oh, this one's rocking out. And I think, as you were saying, Comfortably Numb is one of the two songs that have been beaten to death by FM radio to the point where if it comes on the radio, I'll change the channel. But
but
I think that's because it's out of context. When you listen to the album and you get to Comfortably Numb, because of the way the progression works and you flow from, you know, Bring the Boys Back Home to Comfortably Numb and then The Show Must Go On, the way those all flow together, it's like now the song belongs. Whereas when you go from, you know, Led Zeppelin, Hey Hey Mama, and then you jump to Comfortably Numb and then you go to ZZ Top, and it's like, it's jarring.
Right.
It doesn't seem to fit any of those, you know, to me, it seems out of place when you listen to it.
Very well said. Yeah, when Boston comes on next, you go, not Boston again. I never want to hear Boston again in my life. And that's no offense to the guys in Boston. It's just, you know, they've probably been the most overkill. But yeah, I'd agree. I agree. That's very well said. I think you're absolutely right. It's you can't skip past it when you're listening to that side of the album, or when you're listening to disc two of your double CD. You can't skip past Comfortably Numb.
No, and it's just like Another Brick in the Wall Part Two. When the song comes on, you've heard it 100,000 times, but when you hear it in context, it just seems so much more impactful. And it's like, now it's like I said, I grew up listening to most of the Pink Floyd songs on the radio, and I'd listened to Dark Side of the Moon, but being younger, I never really got it. And moving into The Wall, I don't think I ever listened to the entire album in high school. I listened to a few songs and that was it. But it was one of those that until I was more mature to able to actually sit down and listen to all, like, I think it's almost an hour and a half of music, just listen to the whole thing beginning to end. That's when I really got it. And it was like, okay, now I understand these songs are hit singles. And it's interesting that those hit singles just happen to be the rock star moments of his life where he wrote the rock star songs. And they pulled those ones out. But the rest of them that wrap around those songs are not poppy tunes. They're not hit singles. They're just part of the flow of the music. And as a rock opera, it all just blends together so well.
Right. And actually, you know, Dark Side of the Moon, as far as I understand, it's about the Wizard of Oz.
Absolutely. Dark Side of the Rainbow.
Yeah, I don't know if you knew that. Yeah. But so then after Comfortably Numb, we have almost a Beach Boys song, you know, in The Show Must Go On. But yeah, then we get into almost hard rock. I mean, Pinky's aggression comes out and the music gets kind of hard rocking. And of course, I mean, the In the Flesh reprise, you know, is when he kind of lets all his hatred out, you know, and this is where he starts to resemble the Nazis. And this is where, actually, you know, hold on, before we go any further, JR, I do have to ask, are there any queers listening to the podcast right now?
Get him up against the wall.
That one in the spotlight, he don't look right to me.
Get him up against the wall.
And it's shocking. It's shocking because, you know, you're listening to this and suddenly, you know, there's there's Roger Waters spewing hatred. Of course, it's in character. It's not like Roger Waters is a racist, but he's spewing hatred, and it's kind of a, it's a little bit shocking. But this is where, again, this is where this character is not your friend. You know, this is where this character, you're kind of going, and this is also where we retreat from him, because, you know, we were okay. We were riding him with the pain, but this is where he starts to, you know, he. And basically, I think in the flesh, he's just letting out all that hatred. And then, of course, Run Like Hell is basically about... That song is the movie portrays it a little bit differently, but if you just listen to the lyrics, that song is basically, you know, I'm completely alone and miserable and lonely, and I hate everything, and I hate myself. So if you're going out and screwing around and having sex and enjoying yourself with your partner, then I'm going to get you. You know, I'm going to send my goons to get you. We're going to send the worms to get you.
And see, I think I got a different meaning from that, meaning in the flesh is basically him being at his worst, his exterior self being at his worst, and Run Like Hell and Waiting for the Worms is more his inside self trying to break free. And that's where we get to stop in the trial, where his inside self, his younger, his childhood self finally breaks free, and he's guilty of showing emotion, and that's where he's starting to break free. He's running away from himself. He's not telling everyone else to run away. He's realizing, oh my God, this is what I've become. I don't want to be this. And he's running. He's the one that's trying to get away from everything, and everything else is trying to push him back behind his wall to be his rock star self to go on. And he doesn't want to do that anymore. He's done. He's had enough.
Yeah, I agree, but I think Waiting for the Worms, I mean, the hatred is full on there. I mean, he's basically talking about a new Britannia Empire and sending, you know, our colored cousins back home again. You know, it's he's certainly not, at that point, he's not redeeming himself. The hatred is full on in Waiting for the Worms, but yeah, beyond that, that's when it sort of catches up with him. His, you know, he's guilty of showing feelings. Of an almost human nature.
Of an almost human nature.
This will not do. And that's a fascinating bit of music right there, because the trial is it's very very Broadway. You know, it's not a rock song. It was co-written with the album's producer. His name I should know, but it escapes me. But yeah, it sounds very... very Broadway. It sounds very, very much like you're stepped out of rock and roll now. And Roger Waters does a brilliant, brilliant job of playing all these different roles. I mean, as far, he's the only vocalist, but when he changes character, you know immediately that he's doing the mother. He's portraying the schoolmaster. He's portraying Pinky's ex-wife, and he's also portraying Pinky and the judge and all these other characters. And he just does it masterfully.
And I would love to go see him do this live, but he's not coming to San Diego, damn it.
Yeah, you know, let's get to that in a second, because we're, you know, because after the trial, then, you know, outside the walls is some of the, you know, that's some really excellent, the very closing of the album is really nice, because, you know, they talk about beating your heart against some mad bugger's wall. You know, it ain't easy. You know, beating your heart and kind of saying, well, you know, it's all these people around him did suffer. I mean, his wife, his mother, the school teacher didn't. The school teacher was a bastard, but you know he he's kind of finally realizing that. But one last thing, one bit of trivia I found out actually from Murdochopedia is that the way the song ends, or the way the album ends, the way Outside the Wall ends, it's basically. The audio track gets cut off, and it actually loops, so it should loop around to the opening. The very opening of the album is actually a bit of audio sliced in half. So if you were to go from the final part of disc two and go immediately to track one, disc one, you'll hear how they intersect.
Yeah, I was going to say the music seems to kind of to blend together. It's because it's a whole circle. It comes back from the beginning and the end, the Alpha, the Omega. Let's all be deep here. but yeah, the actual music and everything, like you said, at the very end of the song is the same music that's at the very beginning of the album. So he's right back where he started. And that's You know, is he back to his childhood? Is he back to his start? Where is he at? And that's where the beginning of the album, you have his demonstrative self doing all the, okay, lights and sound effects. And that's the character that comes back towards the end of the album. So like you said, it starts out there and then it flashes back through his life on how he got there and then shows how he breaks free.
Yeah. Although, I mean, I guess that's kind of an optimistic take that, you know, it doesn't really feel very optimistic. It doesn't really feel like he's kind of broken free and that he's all right now. It feels
like he's broken.
Yeah, it feels like the trial kind of crushes him, you know. And,
yep, and it's over.
And, you know, maybe not necessarily dead, but it feels, yeah, it feels very tragic. It doesn't feel...
Yeah, not dead, but done.
Right. Yeah, I feel that way quite often, actually. but, you know, it's... But, again, it's... You know, the resonance, it's just emotional resonance of this album is, it is flooring. I mean, it's really, for me, there's no comparison. There's nothing else. I mean, I can think of individual songs that are beautiful and that are heart-wrenching, and I can even think of albums that do a good job of playing the heartstrings. But yeah, I think this album really, it emulates the emotions well, and it kind of plays on you just amazingly.
The only album that got remotely close as far as being an actual story like this, I would have to say it's probably Operation Mindcrime by Queensryche, but it doesn't tug at your heartstrings as much as this one does. There's not as many ups and downs. You can kind of follow a storyline there, and you're like, wow, this is kind of intense, but you know somebody's screwing with this guy's head, and basically that's what you learn through the album. This, like you said, it's ups and downs. It's a child growing up and being oppressed by everybody around him to become what they want him to be. And just trying to say, hey, you know, somebody forgot about me in all this that happens. You know, I forgot about myself too.
Right. Yeah. That's a good call. Cause I can't really think of, I think Operation Mindcrime is probably the closest, but it's really nowhere near. It's really not even on the same continent as The Wall, but you're right. It's probably, the next best at this sort of thing. But that's another one where you're like, well, okay, what happened? He's on drugs and he killed the girl he loved for drugs and then he wants out and what?
And he was killing religious leaders and killing political leaders and, you know, he was obviously being brainwashed and who was the guy that was behind it? Who's Mr. X?
Right.
You know, I remember being interested in it when it was out and it was interesting. And then you watch the video and went and see the concert and it was all tied together and you got little clues here and there as far as who Mr. X was, what was going on. It was like, hey, that was cool. Then they came up with Mindcrime 2 that to me just fell flat. It completely failed its fans, in my opinion.
You know, I never heard it because of that reason, that's what I was told. I was told that Mindcrime 2. And actually, I was actually just kind of comically playing the dumb guy. I think Mindcrime does tell a good story, and it's done well, and it's an album of good material. And as far as I'm told, I was kind of warned away from Mindcrime 2 just for that reason, for what you just said. The music isn't as compelling, and the story isn't all that intriguing either. So that's what I've heard. This is, you know, secondhand opinion, but that's why I've stayed away from Mindcrime 2.
Yep. No, I did go out and buy it because I was so... And this is actually before I discovered The Wall, is I started listening. I listened to Mindcrime, you know, like I said, the video, the concert, everything, followed it all, thought it was great. And when I got to Mindcrime 2, I was like, wow, they couldn't have produced a bigger turd. And it was around that time that I'm like, you know, I should start going back and listening to some of this older music that I used to like. You know, my dad loved Pink Floyd. And he loved listening to The Wall. He always had a story about The Wall. Anytime he talked to him, he'd, oh, yeah, I remember neighbors were making a lot of noise, so I turned up the speakers, turned them toward the wall, cranked it all the way up, and I turned around and left The Dark Side of the Moon playing. Came back, and dishes had fallen out of the cabinets. It's like, okay. So I decided, you know, I should go back and listen to Pink Floyd and actually listen to the entire album because everyone always said, wait, you mean you just listened to these couple of songs? You've never heard the entire thing? It's like, no, I just know these few songs. No. Go listen to the entire album, then come back and talk to me. It's like, yeah, I think I will. So it probably wasn't until 10 years ago that I really actually listened to the entirety of Dark Side of the Moon, The Wall, Animals, albums like that. So my experience with Pink Floyd, yes, I had some high school experience with it back in the 80s, but it wasn't until early 2000s that I really got into it and really started to go, why didn't I listen to this earlier? Where have I been? Where have I been all my life?
Nice. Yeah. I totally agree. And I will repeat what you said earlier. If any individual song off of Dark Side or The Wall just shuffles on at random, I will usually skip ahead because I don't want it without the context. I want the context. And as you said, and to move on to the other thing that you touched on is, yes, this is it's good that we're having this discussion here in 2010 because this is the 30th anniversary of The Wall, and Roger Waters is doing a 30th anniversary little tour.
The final tour of The Wall, according to him. It will be the last time he ever plays any song off of The Wall, is what he said.
Well, that's not surprising. That's kind of Roger Waters.
yeah, I think he said it before.
yeah, he's, but you know, he is the mastermind behind The Wall, and so there you go. If you're able to, I mean, I don't know if I'll be able to go, but I certainly hope to be able to see them do that show, and I hope you can find some venue somewhere in the Southwest, JR, where you can go and catch Pink Floyd The Wall. Although hopefully it would be the classy thing to do, Roger, if you're listening, it would be the classy thing to do to get to get Nick Mason and David Gilmour. So I'm just saying, you know, that would be the cool thing to do.
Because we know that he's listening.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure he is.
As soon as you post it and put The Wall on it, he'll find it.
That's right, because he'll be dying to hear yet another internet take on his masterpiece.
That's right. He'll do a Google vanity search for Jack Mangan, Deadpan Wall.
That's right. And I do that all the time anyway. So, but anyway, I think we've I don't know if we've done it justice, but and hopefully I think JR actually 30 years from now, people will be looking back on this podcast episode with the same reverence and amazement that they do with The Wall.
And the same emotional commitment.
That's right. People will just sit down and listen and they will get, you know, let the album alter their mental state, and I think that people will have that connection with this episode. I'm going to choose to believe that.
As long as you choose to believe that, in your mind, it will be true.
This would be a great point to quote the album, but I will just sit here in my pair of Goat Hills boots and my Faden Roots. Thank you very much for coming on, JR, I think we did a good job, and everyone out there, I'd love to get your takes on Pink Floyd, The Wall, the movie, the album, the breakfast cereal, whatever you got.
Hey, now don't be messing with my Floyd flakes.
Your Floyd flakes. I pity the fool that don't eat. Oh wait, no, I'm sorry, that's a different. Yeah, Pink Flakes. Yeah, there you go.
My Floyd loops.
Yeah, you know what? I think that's one I will not be having. Thank you. I think that's that's a breakfast cereal. I will, you know, people do not eat this breakfast cereal and drive or operate heavy machinery.
Otherwise, you shall run into the wall.
That's right. Remember to take shelter from pigs on the wing.
There you go.
So, all right. Well, thank you, JR. And thank you out there for indulging us our 45 minutes on Pink Floyd, The Wall.
Pink Floyd, and the only thing that we missed was all the lawsuits that entailed from Pink Floyd, The Wall, which I thought was interesting reading about it. I think he actually suffered from three lawsuits. He actually had the operator who was on the phone sued him. The students who chanted "All in All, We're Another Brick in the Wall" sued them. And one of the actors who was on the TV show that was playing in the background on one of the songs sued them.
No kidding. Wow. Talk about a surprise, surprise, surprise. Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was Gomer Pyle, by the way, that said surprise, surprise, surprise.
Surprise, surprise, surprise.
Yes. And actually, I know, you know, it also was the destruction. Richard Wright was kicked out of the band. He played on this album as a studio session keyboardist. You know, he wasn't even in the band. He and Roger Waters weren't speaking. Roger Waters had already, you know, was giving him the hand at that point. He was saying, talk to the hand. So it was it was a, of course, as a piece of art, it is an absolute success. But yeah, for Roger Waters, I mean, it came with at a pretty high cost.
Yeah, from what I understand, they were almost, as a band, they were almost bankrupt when they released this album.
Yeah, and that's true. And the tour they did, actually the concerts were so expensive they couldn't tour. They played I think they played a show in America, at least. I think they played in New York and in Los Angeles, and that was it, because they couldn't afford to take it on the road. It was such an elaborate show.
I can't imagine why it wouldn't be expensive.
Well, hopefully the one this year will be that expensive, and hopefully we'll all be there. Hopefully we'll all get to go out and see, you know, the final performance of The Wall.
Enjoy some pieces of it.
I got second sight, got amazing powers of observation. So I know. I try to get through, telephone to you. Strong as a fly, and I got nowhere to fly to. Ooh, Ben, I pick up the phone. Still nobody home.